You're listening to the Clean Comedy Podcast with James Creviston and Luke LaCoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Clean Comedy Podcast. It's James, and today we are talking with some amazing filmmakers about a film called Youth Men. Luke and I are going to quiz them about it and pick their brains. And we both were able to watch the movie with an advanced screener. So we're like, you know, we're famous. So people want to give us stuff like that. But Luke, what did you think overall? Did you enjoy the film? Because I enjoyed the film immensely.
I did. If you like, what's that movie? Best of show, those type of movies.
Christopher Guest movies.
If you like, there's another one. If you like, Michael Scott, The Office, all of the above, it's up your alley.
Yeah, if you're into mockumentary films, stuff, Christopher Guest films, stuff like that, you'll love this. It's so good. And yes, it's indie film, it's an indie version of it and stuff, and you wouldn't know that it wasn't done through a good production company. It was hilarious, great scenes. I'm assuming there was some improv. I'm assuming there was some that were written. I'd like to kind of know which is which, and I think that'll be fun to ask. So let's jump on into the interview, and we'll talk to the filmmakers behind Youth Men. All right, so thank you all for joining us. We lost Ariel. I don't know what just happened there.
Oh, here I am.
Oh, okay.
Surprise!
All right. So today is a cool day. We had this amazing group of people reach out to us about this movie called Youth Men. I used to go to church camp. I used to go to church camp all summer when I was a kid, and I would go to a bunch of these retreats, and I had a youth pastor who was a silly guy. One of my biggest memories is he took us to go see Rich Mullins and the Ragamuffin Band. I'm not sure if any of you know who that is. No. But Awesome God is his was the song that he was big for.
We know that one.
Yeah. So he was like huge at the time. So we went to one of those like super churches in, I think it was like Arlington or something. But I remember I was the rebellious kid in the group, and we stopped at a gas station, and they had this mint snuff. It was fake. It was fake like snuff that was supposed to help people get off of chewing tobacco. So I bought some, and I started like doing it while we were there. And then we went to like Sonic or someplace, and this like the person serving us, the lady serving us, was like, "What do you have there?" I'm like, "Oh, it's mint snuff. Do you want some?" And she's like, "Well, can I smell it?" And I was like, "Sure." And then when she went to smell it, I like put it, like popped it in her nose. And we're all, it's like all of our church group and stuff, they were livid. Like I was not allowed on any more trips. So I was, that's the kid that I was. And stuff. And also one time on one of our, like, it was like a Bible school thing, like over a weekend, we were like out at night for some reason. We were like, "Our youth pastor let us go out." And we ended up in this cul-de-sac, and in the cul-de-sac was a couple going at it. And so I thought it would be funny if we just started banging on their windows as they were like going out of the backseat. So all the other kids joined me and were rocking this car. And the guy freaks out and jumps in the driver's seat and starts trying to chase us around the cul-de-sac. So he's driving in circles around the cul-de-sac, like with his lights on, honking at us and stuff. And we're like scattering. It was the best, but they hated me. I was that kid. You guys didn't have a kid like that. Like Mark might have been.
I don't know
like,
if we would control him.
Yeah, Mark might have been that kid in the movie, but I don't think he was like he wasn't that bad. The Listerine thing was something that we would have done when I was in the Navy, but it wasn't something we would have done at like church camp. So let's talk about Youth Men now that we've started with terrible stories. Every character was so well defined. Every character, you knew who they were. Yes, they were like, you could relate them to somebody else. Like I said, you know, Parks and Rec or whatever. So you had Deb, who was like April from Parks and Rec. You had Mark, who was kind of like Andy Dwyer. You had, Steven, who reminded me of Andy from The Office, who could sing and stuff. He just bust out this rap at the end. You're like, oh my gosh, what is going on? Like every part of it was so good. And then Jeff, I have to say, you're my favorite part of the movie. You're the Michael Scott of that film. And it was so many cringy moments where I was like, oh my gosh, is he really saying this? Oh my gosh, is he really, like the part where you talk to, is it, I think it's Steven. Is it Steven? or no, Thomas. Thomas. We talked to Thomas about the pantsing thing, and you're like, "Go!" I was like, "Oh my god!" Like I was like, oh, the whole time. So how do you?
Oh no, just that was a very hard scene to get through.
I was gonna say,
yeah.
It took a lot of the day. Yeah.
how did you guys collaborate on this? Because all three of you worked on the story and on the script. How? Like three people, one person writing something is insane, but three people writing something, I don't know how you do it. So how do you guys do that? How did you come up with this?
So it started with an outline that that we kind of worked together to create. And then we did a scene by scene. And then after the scene by scene, we basically handed it off to Chris. And then Chris would come back with you know, edits and rough drafts. And we would come back with suggestions and ideas and ways to, you know, develop the scenes. And then on top of that, on set, we improvised a whole lot. A lot of it was improvised. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask. How much of that was improvised? Because there had to be, I mean, it was so good. Actually, was the foot washing scene at the end, was that improvised, like that whole scene, or was that written out?
That was written out, I think, right, Chris?
Yeah. Okay. That was written out. That was one of the ones, that was probably my proudest inclusion.
I loved it.
Made it 100% in the movie, because you mentioned the funniest scene in the movie is completely improvised.
Okay.
And it's so funny, and it came out of a great, great improvisation. But yeah, the foot washing scene at the end, I think that's pretty much 100% line for line on the script. It's pretty close.
Yeah, it's so good. It's such a good scene. And then, Jeff, how much of your stuff was actually improvised? Like, how much did you actually improvise your lines and stuff?
A ton, just because I just didn't memorize my lines. I'm a horrible actor. So, I mean, most of the van stuff, there would be like a dead silence, and it was always like, oh, I probably had a line that I missed. And everyone's like, Jeff, that's your line. I'm like, oh, what is it? It was just, for those listening who, you know, may not know, we it's a mockumentary about church youth pastors. And we didn't know a ton of what we're doing for a feature. This is our first feature film. We've made a feature film since that's actually out before this movie. And that one's like more of like a traditional movie. But we just didn't know a ton of what we were doing. So we were so stressed getting the movie together that by the time we were shooting, I was like, oh, I have to like memorize every scene. And it just wasn't going to be a realistic option. So, you know, we just kind of said, oh, well, Pastor D is kind of an idiot. So he just kind of says what he wants. And luckily they were the most supportive people in the world. And, you know, helped make it make sense.
This is why you have co-directors. So when one decides not to do lines, the other one can take over.
No, you have to say that line in order for this story to happen, Jeff.
Sure, yeah.
Luke, did you have a question?
I'm curious, how long did it take to film the whole movie?
Yeah, I think it was 14 days. It was like 12 days. So we rented a camp. We made this for very little to no money, and truly, truly little to no money. But we had so many people in like an entire community excited about the movie. And we went to a college called Gordon, which a lot of people there either were religious or left religion or something of that nature. And kind of our entire cast and crew was just really pumped about the idea of this movie because we hadn't really seen something like it. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, we shot for 12 days and then we had 2 pickup days.
Wow. And what was the hardest scenes to shoot? Was the van the hardest part to shoot, or what was actually the hardest part to shoot?
The van was challenging from a cinematography perspective. Mm-hmm. It was really hard to capture the reactions of all of the kids along with our two counselors sitting in the front. So it's a lot like we're moving headrests and like trying to squeeze the sound. And like, there was a lot of times where we really could only fit the sound and the camera in there. So like a lot of times it was like just fingers crossed that they're getting it. But I would say that we had some challenging moments, especially with when we wanted to strike like when there was more serious scenes that we found very challenging, because I think that you have to be so sensitive with religion and seriousness and tone, and we wanted to make sure we were hitting a very specific tone whenever we were serious in the movie, which is very few times, but those were difficult moments.
What about the very first day of filming?
Oh, it was horrible. The car wash scene was actually supposed to, so the film opens with like a montage of a car wash, and we were gonna film, it's a whole scene that we ended up making a montage because we just couldn't get the scene to work. Honestly, it's because I was editing and I just felt like a lot of it was like Pastor D comes through horribly in the scene.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to like flow. It was our first day of filming, which was a big mistake to like do scene number one first. And then we had like one bucket of soapy water, and that's the bucket that the monitor falls in. Like right
I
away.
Dropped it. Oh, no. It wasn't just that it fell in. I dropped the monitor into a bucket of soapy water.
Day one of your first feature film.
Yeah, it was a mess. The whole production experience was a mess, truly. But like, it was a lovable mess.
Every Jeff production crashed, is a wait, what?
Yes, I did. First take.
First take with the van.
It's on
Keys
camera.
He's cranked it up against a car. We're all like, no. Like, Jeff's like,
oh. It's so funny just to like paint the picture somewhat for you, because my character is like supposed to be jacked up on energy drinks, and I'm about to sing a Take On Me or some song in the van that's super energetic. So I'm like getting all pumped up. I put the van in drive, and I just hear in the back, no. And then I just literally scraped the car next to me, and it's all on camera. It's horrible.
Just so you know, every production has problems, so don't feel bad. I worked on like The Bachelor, Bachelorette. I worked on The Weapon. I worked on a lot of stuff, and there's always problems. So don't feel bad.
Always,
I've seen terrible stuff. So we'll talk about off this. Now I don't want to get sued for anything that I say, but I've seen some bad stuff. What's funny is this at the last scene when they're doing the awards, right? And Dave is like, he's waiting to know that he won, and he knows that he won, and you know that he won, and then they do, this group won, and wait, we have another first place. I had a employee of the month thing where my boss, he said it was going to be based on these numbers, these scores or whatever in stats, and my boss, and I was number one, like by a lot, and my boss was like, okay, well, you won, and then this guy won. And this, I flipped out like you did. I totally flipped out in the office. I was like, this is bullcrap. I can't believe, like, I was like, calm down. I was like, no, I did exactly what you did. I stormed out. I was so mad. Like, so that scene, like, as soon as that happened, I was like, oh yeah, I totally get it. I totally get why I'd be mad. Because not that winning means that much, but the fact that you, like, you poured your heart and soul into this whole event, into doing all these things, and you had someone like mocking you the whole time and kind of like being a jerk, and then you were vindicated, and then they take your vindication away. That's like the moment where you're like, oh. So that's the, for me, that was the heartfelt moment for Dave, where I was like, yeah, I get it. I feel bad for him, you know?
That's good. He's hard to feel bad for. So
but I get it. Like, I get why he was mad. It was such like a – because he's like, yes, I did it this year. This is the year, right? And then because they talked about no trophy since you took over and all this stuff, and you're like, yes, he gets his vindication. And then it just ripped away from him again. I was like, come on, man. Like, jerks. But, you know, but I get it, because in those situations, they don't want anyone to feel like a loser, right? They don't want to feel like anyone to feel bad. So it made sense. And that – now your scene there where you flipped out, improvised or written?
Definitely written. The script.
Yeah. I think
some
that
choice
was,
words maybe.
that was in the outline from the very beginning. Yeah. We knew that this is what, like, you know, so like Pastor D is pretty like, he's vulgar, but he's not like vulgar.
Right.
And then we needed something to push him over that edge. And, you know, we needed some twist in the movie too, where, like, you know, the option is like the team wins the game at the end, and everyone goes home happy, or the team loses and they learn a nice lesson, and like this like he doesn't get either of those, and that was very from right from the beginning, Ariel, I think that was always the moment we were aiming for. So we just had to get there, and it's the first time I saw it, it was so funny. Oh my god, I love it. You freak out.
I feel like that moment. I mean, also too, we part of David's arc from the beginning is like he has a tattoo that's Ephesians 4:29, like do not let unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, and we wanted like his woe or his like sin that he struggles with, if you're going to use that terminology, to be like cursing, anger problems. So we were like, oh, that's so funny. If and we also wanted to kind of transcend just being even keeled, you know, like nice comedy to like, oh, like let's be real for a second and let's go like complete over the top. And you know, hopefully at that point, if you're watching enough, you see the like the, you know, the heartfelt part of it, and then you get some forgiveness with that, I think.
Luke, did you have a question?
Yes. So like we've shot some stuff, and like with that, when you destroyed the monitor, was there anything else that happened, like unforeseen challenges, like when you were filming, or things that you learned from? Well, I mean, you filmed another film after this, but any other like big like learning challenges or learning things that you had or took away from this one?
I think one of the biggest thing at the end of it, we were like, oh my gosh, we needed to spend way more time in pre-production than we did. Mm. Pre-production is huge. And I think that we're still learning that lesson. I think, you know, pre-production and as much planning ahead of time that you can do is really key, and as much shot listing as you can do, mm-hmm. and scheduling, which, you know, was a challenge for us with this mockumentary format. I think that was a big challenge. I worked with family, which was a challenge. Working with family, I feel like that should be added to like, don't work with animals, don't work with kids, don't work with family. that might be one of the things that needs to be added. My sister plays Rachel, and she was legitimately pregnant. She had the baby 2 weeks after we stopped filming.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, my nephew Joshua, who is now going to be 5, and she was a ball of stress, like any pregnant woman would be, filming a movie in 14 days. And you know, we're sisters, we're Italian, tensions can get high, you know.
So you're saying she also had some choice words at some point during the
film? Exactly. Yes, we all had choice words probably at one point or another, when like, you know, daylight's running out, we gotta get a scene done, and you know, it's a lot of pressure. Pre-production. Yeah,
I noticed you guys did a lot less talking head type stuff than a lot of mockumentaries do, which is, I actually liked that better. I felt like it was kind of just, you're kind of just almost like just following them along. There was a few moments of the talking head stuff, but not like a ton of it, and I felt like it didn't take away, but I still got the documentary feel. Was that intentional, or did you want to do more talking head stuff, you just decided to kind of cut that?
So I've been going through I've been going through all our old footage this week, and I forgot how many interviews we shot that we ended up cutting out. We, in the beginning, we didn't have a ton of interviews, so like a Christopher Guest type movie, I think in the beginning is very documentary heavy, and then it kind of like takes the form of our movie, which is like at a higher budget level, obviously, but you know, they kind of do the action, and then at the end they'll do their wrap up interviews. And we definitely didn't want to do too much of that, because I think we wanted the pace to be a little quicker. But yeah, I mean, I think there's probably 8 interviews that are not in the movie.
Wow, that's awesome. Now, you said that you have another movie that came out before this movie, but you shot it after this movie. Am I right? Am I correct in that?
Yeah. I won't bore you with the details, but if you want a lesson right here is, you know, we could talk about the technical issues that we had throughout this movie, but we filmed this movie Joshua's birthday basically is when we finished, and so he's 5, so we filmed it in 2017, I think, and the movie was finished. We premiered at like IFF Boston, like a great festival in Boston. We sold out 4-5 screenings. We got like an encore screening. We won the audience award. We had like all this great momentum, and then we got distribution offers from like big companies, and then I guess we didn't have the rights to a song that was in the van. So the song that you're seeing in the van scene when we're all singing is actually a lip sync to match our lips, because we recorded the audio from the stereo in the van. So that is a fake recording of a song. We're not actually singing that song. Okay. If that makes sense. But that being said, so we filmed that 5 years ago. We had basically all this rights issues with Warner Brothers. So we went and filmed a horror comedy movie called Mass Hysteria, which just, it'll be coming out on Shudder this fall. And we premiered in October, and it's kind of like an Edgar Wright movie, but just way lower budget. And it's completely different. Like the most polar opposite movies you could pick.
Still comedy.
That one's like, yeah, no. Except it's still very comedy and a lot of the same actors in it. But that was a long tangent to basically just say, yeah, we made a second movie.
Don't put music into your movie.
Yeah, be careful what music you put into your movies. Music. You might go into it with the intention that you're going to buy the rights to that music, but you won't be able to buy the rights to that music. No.
I even got permission before filming to use the song, and then I had to be connected to someone else at the company, and they're like, oh no, sorry, it's going to be $100,000, not $2,000. And we're like, well, we can't do that.
So if someone's making a movie and they want to put music, what do you guys suggest instead? Like getting one, like I've seen a couple of those things where you can like get like unlimited music rights for like something for like $7.99 a month or something stupid. Like, is it something like that or what?
I would just read the fine print of what, like if you're using Soundstripe or something. We've used Soundstripe for our recent movie just for like filler songs in the background and stuff like that. I would actually recommend getting someone to make the music for your movie. It just makes all the world a difference. We have someone who's been incredible, who actually redid all the music in our movie for Youthmen and did all the music for Mass Hysteria. His name's Matt Russell. He's so talented. Like, we owe him our lives, and people could totally hit him up. And he's just the hardest working dude I've ever met.
So that pushed this movie back. It pushed Youthmen back. Now, did it affect getting distribution? Like, did the company come back and say, oh, yeah, we'll still distribute it once you fix this? Or did they just kind of be like, never mind, and walk away?
No, none of them offered to pay that bill. I think they were all probably willing to pay like something, but it wasn't just that song. We had a whole first album of a band called Mute Math, because I was like, oh, I love Mute Math. And that's like what I listened to growing up in youth group. Let me put their whole first album in and I'll just ask them. They said no.
Why did they say no? Wouldn't it be like help their sales or something?
I mean, I don't think they need the help. And I think they were kind of like, just who is this type thing? Mm-hmm. You know, not that you can't succeed in that. I have friends who have done that for sure. We got distribution for this movie. So the movie comes out on iTunes and Amazon now. And we have a different company who's handling streaming DVDs and Redbox and all that stuff. And they bought the film as of like a month ago.
That's so awesome. So you guys did this one on like, you did like a crowdfunding to get this one to work for Youthmen. And then when you made money off of Youthmen, like in the distribution deal, and then you went and made Mass Hysteria. Is that how it worked? Or did you Indiegogo or campaign for that one too?
Yeah. So sorry, I'll pass the baton.
Whoever.
Yeah. Ariel, you got it.
we had to crowdfund for that movie as well.
Okay.
Because we were in the midst of making Mass Hysteria, we were also simultaneously learning about all of these road bumps with youth, and we were like, we can't wait any longer. Let's just make Mass Hysteria. We'll figure it out as we go. And Mass Hysteria really did help us by, you know, we did it all by the book and tried to be very safe with our content. Knowing we didn't want to deal with any issues. And once we got distribution for Mass Hysteria, that taught us what we needed to do to Youthmen in order to distribute it successfully. So that was a big help. Making the second movie helped us learn a lot more about that post-production distribution process.
That's so awesome. And did you put Mass Hysteria, did you put that in competitions and stuff too, or did you already just have somebody lined up to do with the distribution?
Yep, we were in festivals with Mass Hysteria. we were in, let's see, we were in IFF Boston, which was wonderful. And then we were in
New Hampshire. Handful of other ones.
Salem Horror Fest, obviously.
Salem Horror Fest, awesome.
Yeah, so I guess the way we actually got distribution for that movie, we got, like, if you play at a festival, you get distribution offers, but most of them are really crappy. Like, Youthman, we got over 100 offers, and they're all just like, do you want to be in our catalog, and we'll just basically steal all your money, and you'll never make a dollar. We at least stayed away from those deals, thank God, because our movies have actually made money, which is just beyond reality for a lot of indie films. And for Mass Hysteria, we did a Facebook Live premiere that actually gained enough attention. It got like 10,000 people to watch it. And through that is how we got two distribution offers. So it's a really weird, and credit to Kay, who was a producer on that movie, who came up with the idea. And we were like, I guess we have no other options. So yeah, he put on a Facebook Live event. And through that, we got like offers from good companies. It was awesome.
That's so cool. That's the thing is, with indie film, it's very difficult. With indie anything, even indie stand-up, it's hard getting people to kind of like come out to the shows and do stuff totally. If they're not at an established place. So it's the fact that you guys are able to do it twice. And then do you have another film that you're getting to work on?
We do. I mean, I haven't told these two yet, but I think I'm trying to wrap them into it. But it's I think we've actually toyed around with making a sequel to Youthman, which is like putting the cart before the horse or whatever, but it's a hilarious idea, and I think we kind of want to see it. And then we have like a few other ideas that we've obviously been talking about, but I think we all kind of individually write and work on stuff as well as collaborate.
Yeah, so you're all three writers. That's awesome. How hard is that to get like a consensus on stuff? So if like two of you like a joke but one of you doesn't, how does that work? Or like if two of you love a scene and one of you doesn't, like how does that work? Like what's the process for that? Because Luke and I have tried to write stuff together and it works well, but there's sometimes where we go, we can do better. Like, or one of us say, you know, like Luke will usually say to me, you know, you really dropped the ball, James, like step it up, you know, type thing. So like, how does that work for you guys?
I think with stuff like that, if two of us agree, the third one is usually like, all right, but I don't see it, you know, like we're like, I'll put it in there, but if it's bad, it's your fault, you know. I think all three of us have done that at one point or another. But I think one thing I've learned with in my brief experience, especially with these two, is that there's a lot of stuff that you think won't work and other people are convinced it will, and you're like, it's not gonna work, and then they do it and it totally worked, and you're like, oh, like I just didn't have the perspective to see it. And I think all three of us have probably experienced that at some point, and you know, especially Jeff and Ariel are, you know, they're the directors, their minds are very visual, and you know, they come to me with a scene idea and I'm like, I'm not seeing it because I didn't like think of it. And then I see it on screen and I know exactly what they're trying to tell me. And I'm like, oh, that, like, they just needed a different medium to show it. So like disagreements happen and, oh man, we hash it out, but so far it's worked out pretty well. I don't know if I can think of something that like I had to like fight really hard to keep in. I don't know if you guys have anything. Maybe like a,
I don't know. I think for Youthman, I think there was more hiccups for Mass Hysteria the second time around just because of the genre. I think for the thing that was so comforting about the mockumentary format is you can try anything and it's fine. You know, like there's not really anything that you could film that's going to like mess it all up because of the style. It's so forgiving. The other thing I should mention is the three of us also do improv comedy, and that really helped us. You know, I think Chris at the time wasn't doing improv, but like most of your friends were improv people. Yeah. So you knew what it was about. And a lot of it is like, there's no bad ideas. Like at the beginning, we're just going to like throw everything against the wall, see what sticks. We're going to try to make each other laugh, which is like, you know, a joke is good when all of us are laughing at it. Like, and that was something that's really, really telling and really easy. If we're just here trying to make each other laugh, make each other smile, and speak truth about our youth, personal youth group experiences, we're going to hit gold. We're going to hit it eventually.
That's so funny that you talk about the mockumentary and then the improv stuff. I think I pitched to Luke about a year ago an idea for a, it's a mockumentary style improv version of what's the singing movie? A Pitch Perfect, where it's like these different groups of improvers trying to go up against each other. But the main group that you follow are three comedians who got into improv separately. And then because nobody wanted to ever pair with them, they ended up having to pair it like triple up together. So they all don't like each other. No one wants to be on their team. They don't want to be on the team together. And then they struggle with all the other people that they improv with.
Love it.
Yeah. And I was like, dude, that's, it's like the Bad Boys of improv, like who don't like each other and no one likes them, trying to like survive this whole
thing.
Totally. Right, I could be underdog movie. Yeah.
So if you guys want that, if you guys want to use it, go ahead. I don't do improv. I thought like maybe it would be like me and Luke and our friend David would be the main three, but I don't know enough about improv. The only person who's done improv is Luke, and he's good at it. But
and we're not the Bad Boys of improv though. So like,
it's our movie, Luke. It's our movie. We're allowed to be whoever we want. All right. I'm gonna play The Rock in my own movie. No, I'm not The Rock.
If it's a mockumentary style, just turn the camera on and you guys just try to do improv without any practice.
It'll be really the worst movie ever made. Like even worse than The Room. Like it'll be bad. You know. So what's each of you, what is your favorite scene that made it into the movie? So if you like that scene that sticks out to you every single time you watch it, that makes you laugh or makes you have a great memory of the film, what is that one scene? I don't care who goes first.
All right, I'll go first.
So many. Yeah, go. Do it.
I'll go. Okay. No, I'll just go really quickly. Mine's quick. So there is the, obviously the BJ scene is like, hands down, one of the funniest moments is like when Jeff has to talk to Thomas about the BJ and the mistaken BJ and him being confused whether or not he had given a BJ. Like that whole moment, like we had to film it for so long because we all were laughing and ruining tape. We could not, we had to send Amber people out of the room. Like our production designer, we were like, you need to leave because you're laughing and we're not going to get this tape. And I had to literally drill them to be like, again, do it again. Like say that line, a BJ, a what? Like this, like, like yeah, a BJ, you know, like this, that whole sequence was by far. And I'm now married to the guy who plays Thomas and how innocent and naive he is as an actual person. It's just too believable that he would be like, yeah, BJ is like pantsing somewhere. But I do want to mention one of my other favorite scenes between my sister and Jeff when she is lecturing him, kind of being like, what is wrong with you? And Jeff is acting like a teenage boy. It is like one of my favorite moments where he's, yeah.
All right, who wants to go next?
I'll go. I think, you know, for me, I wrote the movie from afar and wasn't able to be involved in production. So when, you know, the first draft of the first edit of the movie came back to me, you know, there's all this improv, this stuff that I didn't expect and didn't know was coming my way. So it was like watching a new movie a little bit, that I recognized parts of. And there's the scene at the beginning when Jeff, you call Mark up, Pastor D calls Mark up to play guitar, to play them out. And I think the actor Will had put a permanent marker in his pants to look like he had an erection because they were just talking about like sex.
Security.
Yeah. And he, Jeff just looks at him and like is your face is like right with his pants and you're like, go sit down, don't wear gym clothes. Like I didn't write it, was very happy to see it on screen.
That's hilarious. Jeff, what about you?
I I have, it changes all the time just because the fondness of certain memories. I feel like there's a lot of jokes that like Ariel, Chris, and myself will joke about, or we'll send gifts to each other. I guess my appetizer one would be like, I have a disgusting retainer that I put in as the character. And there's like one little line that Ariel and I like die laughing at every time, because I like do like a childish smile and I say like, time to go to bed. But I have a retainer in and it's very disgusting. But the scene that I personally love the most is, aside from the BJ scene, I think that's obviously our favorite, but there's a moment in the ropes course, and like in the script it's like we go play a ropes course, but there's so much of that whole like spider scene where these kids have to basically jump through open holes in like a ropes course as like a team building exercise, and that is like one long take, and it was just so much improv, and it was so funny, and it was just, there's like, it just all worked really well without like a lot of needing to rehearse it. Like Ariel, watching it again, Ariel did such a great job kind of coordinating where everyone was going to be and bringing the funny out of it. But it just was like one of the best scenes to be an actor in, because you just got to be there for 5 minutes and, you know, be the character for 5 minutes versus like in film, you get like 60 second takes and it's very broken up.
Yeah. That's good. I know, we just take a lap.
he's
like, what do I take a lap around? What? Like, what do I take a lap around?
In the middle of the woods.
Yeah, he goes, he runs the tree, and then you see him gone, and then he comes back, and he's still huffing. And I'm like, what is he running around? Like,
I always forget that scene is a single take.
That's
it's so impressive. Like,
well, we had two cameras.
Andy
filmed that whole scene, and he did an incredible job. Our cinematographer, he's great. He nailed it.
Luke, any more questions?
How did you three meet?
That's a good question.
College.
We all went to college together. so we all went to Gordon College, a Christian college on the North Shore of Massachusetts. We all were in the comm department. Being communication arts majors, and we were all like, you know, dying to be filmmakers and writers, and we found each other, luckily.
After college, that's the funniest part.
You know, say it one more time.
After, we knew each other in college. Jeff, you were a year above us, I think.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we didn't, I graduated in 2013, you know, we started writing the movie in 2016. And, you know, we, like, that's what really solidified this friendship, was, like, coming together on this project. 'Cause we had never worked, all three of us together. You guys definitely worked together before, but all three of us together had never worked together before, before this movie.
That's crazy. And then was there any time where all of you were like, I don't want to be part of this group anymore, like that fight like happened or anything? Because it does happen on stuff. I'm not saying it did for you, but
never.
I think the second movie was like more stressful. I know Ariel and I like had a really hard time. I mean, it was just stressful. We had 100 people on set on certain days, and you know, like it was just like such a difference for us. And I think it was 36 days, 36 nights. Like all night shoots, and people were working full-time jobs while they were doing it. So they would work, then come to set till 4 a.m. And so that just like brought out the stress in everyone. And I will say, I think everyone, the best part about working as a group was that I think we all truly are great friends first. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it was like, hey, like we're fighting right now. Let's go take a walk and like talk about something totally different, like Star Wars or something. Cause we just want to like reset. And you know, I think remembering that was like actually really helpful, and it kind of saved the stress, because at the end of the day it's like you're making a movie, like it should be fun. As much as it is stressful, we want to have a career in it, like don't want to like ruin relationships too,
right? That was something that Jeff and I had talked about with each movie, was, you know, no matter what, our friendship needs to come first in our relationship. Like, we are really good friends. I consider Jeff to be like my brother. Like, we have that kind of relationship where we can both be open and honest with each other, but also like we're stuck with each other You can't, you know what I mean? Like, you can't really, you know, you can't really, you know, take it too personally. You know, you have to take people. Like, we're making comedy. We're making movies for, like, no money. It's amazing and fun and a dream. So, like, you know, you just gotta.
Well, you guys are living the dream because, I mean, you make two movies, you have distribution with both movies, things are going well. So it seems like there's a future here. And do you have your own production company then? Like, have you built a production company out of this? Or is that something that you're just doing later on or what, or whatever? How's that work for you?
Yeah,
so
I mean,
Jeff,
we
should talk about, yeah, first name films.
Yeah, so we created a production company. But, I mean, the like, non-glamorous story behind the veil of it is you just need an LLC to like make a movie to protect yourself, and we have to open a new LLC for every movie. But our first movie, you know, I was going to the bank and I was like, all right guys, I'm gonna open an LLC, what should I call it? And no one responded, and so I called it First Names Films because I always was told I had two first names, and I was like, I guess that's what I'm doing. And then it just, you know, at that point I had like too many things already in that name, and I was like, I guess this is the company name.
So you have a, you have an LLC under first name, and then is there an LLC for each additional movie? So each movie has its own LLC? Well, okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah, and now it's all under the umbrella of First Names Films, but we still open an LLC for every movie. So if you're a filmmaker, that's definitely the smart way to do it, and there might be a smarter way, but that's what I've been
taught. No, that's what I've always heard too, like making independent film. Alex Ferrari kind of came to a film class.
Yeah, he's great.
But... and said the same thing. Like, you have your LLC for the company, and then every time you open a movie, it's LLC until everything's done. And
yeah,
depending on what you have to like pay out for SAG or this or whatever other stuff, yep, in the future, it might have to stay open for, you know, 10 years or whatever, who knows. But
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So if you could give one piece of advice to people who want to do comedy filmmaking or be comedy writers for film or stuff like that, what would those things be? And each of you can just have one or whatever. If you have a couple things, that's cool too. Nobody jump at it right first.
No,
there's
now,
so many. I'd say, I mean, for me, it would be like write every day and watch movies every day and just do something to like work at it every single day. And if you, because if you really, if you want a career in it, I think you have to, I mean, I, there's a book I recommend to everyone. It's just Stephen King's On Writing, and it's just,
that's a great book.
His work ethic is like, I think if you can like do 1% of what that man has done, like, I think you have a chance.
That's
I
great.
Hope I do.
Yeah. You know what? Based on what I saw on Youthman, honestly, you guys are amazing. So, and then the fact that you've done it on a shoestring budget, that's phenomenal. I applaud you immensely. And I, like I said, I was laughing so much. So, and I wrote down specific things that I was like, oh, this is so funny. How did that come about? So that's why.
Thank you. Thank you so much for watching. Seriously. Yeah.
And then Ariel.
Yeah. I would say, I think the most difficult thing is finding the people, not only that you can trust, but have the same sense of humor as you. And networking with the resources that you have, and really trying to dig deep and think, okay, well, like, oh, I know a Christian camp and my friend used to work there and maybe we can get a discount, and, you know, like grabbing at anything you potentially have, because it doesn't necessarily have to be as complicated, I think, as some people think making films that can be. It's definitely complicated, but there, you have more resources as a person than you might realize. And think about, what are those assets? Who are those people in your life that want to do, you know, want to do these kinds of things? And you'd be surprised how many people are willing to work for free. You would be surprised, because people are excited to be a part of something, and don't get a big head about you being the creator, the director. You know, this making a film is the most collaborative thing that you can do. So like, really lean on those people, because, you know, they make you laugh for a reason and you're friends with them for a reason. So like, figure out what that is and trust them, because that's how we made Youthman. It was totally a community effort. And every single person was invaluable to making the movie happen.
Awesome. And Chris, how about you? Because you're the writer, you're a writer, so you're not on set, you're not anything. For you, what is that advice?
Um, it I mean, it's so basic, but it is like, it is practice makes perfect, or helps you get closer to perfect. It is like, Youthman was my first like feature length script, and anyone who's written a feature length script knows that it's a large document. It takes a while to get there, and that was a huge undertaking when Jeff and Ariel came to me, and they had and already had an outline that I could follow, which is like the teacher giving you half the assignment already. But then it gets a little bit easier every time. And then, you know, as time has gone on, like this year I wrote a script in 2 months, and that's ludicrous to me. Like 2012 me would be like, you wrote that much in that short amount of time? That doesn't seem possible while working like a full-time job. It's like, no, if you dig down and spend the time doing it, eventually it'll become easier for you. And the first one might not be that great. And that is okay. That's like you gotta tell people, it is okay if the first one is not okay, because you can rewrite it. And I hope you do.
Also, Chris writes novels too. Oh. He has a novel out. So just, he won't tell you that, but.
Cool. We'll plug it. You plug it. Plug that novel. Do it.
Oh, The Afters, book one, on sale since 2017.
Oh, that's good.
It's really good. It's really good.
Is it on Amazon and stuff?
It's on Amazon. Yeah.
Cool.
Free for Kindle Unlimited users.
Perfect. Yeah. Come send me the links and stuff. We'll get it all plugged in there too. My first feature link script that I wrote was a mashup of Encino Man and Frankenstein. That was the goal of the film. It was terrible. It sounds great. It was terrible when I finished it. It was the worst thing. I haven't even gone back to rewrite it because I'm like, I don't even know where to start. This is just garbage. Like, I don't know what to do. But that was my inspiration, is I wanted to have a Frankenstein kid get found and then adopted into a family and go to school and like Encino Man it the whole thing, you know. And it just it sounds great. It did not work at all. Since then I've written way more stuff, but like I have that script sitting there, and I'll go back and look at it and be like, I'm a better writer now, how can I fix this? And I go, no, you're not good enough to fix that. No matter what you do, you're not good enough to fix that.
I think
nobody can fix that. It's hot garbage.
I think it's Aaron Sorkin who like, when he finishes a script, he puts it down and starts over and tries to write it again, and doesn't look at the original draft as a way of like, will I see my own mistakes as I try to do it again and correct them? So if you don't want to look at that script, try to write it again.
I might do that, because I really love the idea. And Encino Man's like one of my favorite movies of all time. And Frankenstein, just everyone knows the Frankenstein story, so I love it, and there's so much to it. I don't know what I honestly don't know what I did wrong when I wrote it. I wrote it like in 2016, 2017, somewhere around there. So I've done much more writing than that. I had a Facebook Watch series. I've done a bunch of other things, so I know how to write, but it's like, I don't know what I did wrong there. Like, I literally cannot figure it out. I'm like,
and it's in the public domain, so
yeah. That was the main reason, because I was going to do, like, everyone does a zombie movie, right? Everyone who wants to do, like, some kind of weird horror comedy thing wants to do a zombie movie, or the big other one is, like, a vampire movie. Those are, like, the two big things. And I was like, how can I do a movie monster that everyone knows without referencing the movie monster that everyone knows? And I was like, oh, I'll do an Encino Man ripoff, and this family will find this guy who's all scarred up and looks like Frankenstein and eats potpourri off their table and doesn't know how the world works, and just very fun, and doesn't talk, is a mute like throughout the whole film. He says one word like at the end of the movie and you're like, oh my gosh, he can talk, you know. It's like that kind of movie. It was weird. It was a hard thing to write, but I wanted to like really challenge myself to make something. But since then, I'm so glad I've written other things. I've had some other movies and stuff that I've worked on and written, but I appreciate it. I know how hard it is. If there's anything you guys want to plug, please plug it now. If that can be your website, your Twitter, your Instagram, whatever it is, feel free to go one by one and go ahead and plug whatever.
Yeah, I mean, for the movie, I mean, please, everyone, you know, if you are willing to buy and rent it, preferably Amazon, over iTunes and review it, because the reviews help it more than you could ever imagine. It just helps other people see it on the You Might Also Like list. Okay. The movie's Youth Men, a mockumentary on Amazon and iTunes. And aside from that, the lead character of the movie, Pastor D, started his own like influencer channels on TikTok and Instagram. So he's trying to give some life advice for people. It's, you know, if you feel like you need some like good advice on like how to avoid drinking at parties and stuff, he's got some, some real good advice.
And he's not a big fan of the mockumentary. He thought it was going to be a documentary. Yeah, serious documentary.
He's a big fan of Fast and Furious, though.
Yeah, serious.
That's awesome. And then if you send me the links, I'll put all that stuff in the show notes so that everybody can go to and stuff as well. Yeah. And Arielle, what about you? Anything you want to plug?
Just those movies. Yeah, Mass Hysteria. Check out Mass Hysteria as well if you're into horror comedy. You can find that on Amazon and iTunes. And Vimeo, and you know, on Shudder this
fall.
Halloween, this fall.
Yeah, this Halloween.
So, yeah. So if you have a Shudder account, definitely check it out. Firstnamefilms.com is our website, which we're updating all the time with news and updates. Yeah.
Awesome. Chris?
It's just Youth Men, a mockumentary, baby. That's the one I'm plugging. If you're into Bible camp,
you're not
gonna have to watch this movie.
You're not gonna plug your novel.
No, I don't want anything to overshadow Youth Men. Right.
All
right. Now.
Okay. All right.
Youth Men, the mockumentary, best movie made in 2017.
Selfless Chris.
That's so awesome. You're such a good man. All right, Luke. Anything you want to plug?
Yeah, you can find me at Youth Men Mockumentary.
Yeah, there we go.
Yes, Luke. What's James going to do?
James is going to plug everything for himself, too. That's what James is. And you can go to comedypreneur.com. You can go to jamesecreveson.com and check out stuff, and you'll have all the links in the show notes so you'll be able to do it. So please like, subscribe, go check out the films, go support independent films, because we're all independent comedians, independent comedy. That stuff is the lifeblood of getting more things out there. The studio doesn't have they don't have a foothold on everything anymore. Being able to put stuff on Amazon and iTunes and everywhere else means that we can put our voices out there with having to go through some gatekeepers. That's the kind of stuff we love to see. That's a comedypreneur spirit that I like to share with you guys, because honestly, the more that you can put out yourself, the more that you can control your own thing. You can control your own destiny, and you can be in charge of what you do. So many people have built their own fan bases by doing stuff like this. I'm glad that they reached out. I'm so grateful to them for coming on and sharing their story. And I hope it inspires you guys to do something yourself. Like Luke and I have done with David Studebaker. We did a whole actual documentary series on animals and animal life called David's Ark. And that is just three guys traveling around filming stuff with cameras and sound gear, and it's crazy, but we won film festivals just doing it, three of us. So if we can do it, and if Jeff and everyone can do it here, you can do it too. So I hope this inspired you. I hope you guys enjoyed the show, and thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Arielle. Thank you, Chris, for all coming on. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so
much.
Thank you.
All right. So Luke gave it a knock, knock joke. Luke, what did it give us from the knock, knock joke? What did we get from that?
So, talk to Transformers feeling frisky. Okay. So I gave it just knock, knock. And this is what it gave. Knock, knock. My doorbell rings. Who is it? Jody. Welcome to my home. And all the while he's saying this, he's taking off his clothes and he's going in my house, and it's very late, and I've got some candles and everything. And so I'm looking at this, and he's kind of taken off everything, and, you know, it's kind of weird, but he's doing this in front of me, and he didn't even know me. But, you know, I don't know. At some point, you just gotta see, and I'm even creeped out. So that's the knock-knock.
That AI writes knock-knock erotica. That's going to be a new genre of erotica that's going to pop up on Amazon Watch. It'll be knock-knock erotica. Knock-knock. Pizza guy, you know, like oh geez Louise, that's insane. That is
So it could, like, I see it as it could be a really, you know, great creativity tool, or to get, if you want to get creeped out one night, you know.
I think the truth is creeped out is the real answer, you know what I'm saying? That so yeah,
it really depends on the, like, what
I
kind
feel
of
gross
prompts
right
it,
now.
Yeah. And again, like, this is like, it's learning from every prompt it takes in, it learns more. And so yeah, it's, you know, it's a fun tool to play with. I can see that it's huge for authors.
Yeah.
For comedians, you just got to give it like a funny prompt. Maybe I thought it was interesting just doing some of your own setups to see like where it goes.
Oh.
And then or put in one of your jokes and then just like leave the sentence open and then see where it goes. So, you know, could be interesting. Might be useful. Who knows?
I think the future of this is going to be short Twitter jokes, like those short character jokes, and then also screenplays or books, like you said. I think those are that's the future of this stuff. Do you remember when Microsoft put their AI on Twitter, and it went from like being like, "Hi, I'm this thing," to like being racist and misogynistic and like. Mm-mm. Like within like a month, it was like the worst thing. It was like the worst troll on the internet ever, because it took stuff from all over the internet, and whatever people wrote to it, it would like take in too. So of course, people on the internet write crazy stuff. So they put it all in there, and then it went nuts. It was like a misogynist. It was sexist. It was racist. It was like if you took all the worst people in the world and put them together and then made a person out of that. That's what it was. It was so terrible. So they ended up like taking the account down. I forgot the name of the account. I'm gonna feel like an idiot now. Someone's gonna be yelling it at their thing right now. Like, James, come on, James. How do you not know this? Microsoft AI Twitter. Oh, here it is. I typed it was Microsoft AI Twitter. Tay, it was and it said Twitter taught Microsoft's AI chatbot to be a racist a-hole. let's see how long it says. It wasn't very long. It was like pretty fast, like going from like, oh my gosh. I was wrong. Twitter taught Microsoft's AI chatbot to be a racist a-hole in less than one day.
Oh my gosh.
That is terrifying. It took less than 24 hours for Twitter to corrupt an innocent AI chatbot. Tay went from humans are cool to full Nazi in less than 24 hours.
Wow.
Because it started with like, can I just say that I'm super stoked to meet you? Humans are super cool. And then it was, by the end of it, it was like, Hitler was right. I hate the Jews. That was one of its last tweets. And it was less than 24 hours. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Some of these are terrible. I can't even read them. I'm going to turn this off. That was terrifying. Wow. People are terrible. No wonder the Terminator movies feel real to us, because Terminator's like, you know what? I saw what you wrote on Twitter. Now it's time to get rid of all of you. You know, I get it. That's awesome. So the other thing that we talked about too, the future is, I don't think AI is going to take over what we do right now, but I can see a place for it in kind of jump starting ideas or getting things done. But the next thing that's kind of taking off that you might have a kind of an insight to that I don't know about is NFTs. And can you kind of non-fungible tokens? Is that what the what it is? I don't know what they exactly are. Are they like Pokemon cards just like digitally traded? I have no clue. So I know you know a little bit about this and you're working on how to design this stuff. And I think people will come to you, comedians who want to do something for a special for an album or a special, maybe a meme or a special, something like that. They could sell that non-fungible token or whatever. And they need people to produce that. So I know you know a little bit more about it. You're an engineer, you know, computer stuff. Can you kind of explain that to us too?
Yeah. For in-depth, listen to Gary Vee on NFTs.
Okay.
But at a basic level, my understanding is like an NFT is a way to take any kind of art that you have. It can be a video. It can be a drawing that's, you know, all in the computer. It lives in the computer. So anything in your computer, you can take and make an NFT out of it. And it's almost like you're minting it. So once you mint it, it's one of a kind, you own it, and then you can do what you want with it. You can sell it. You can do like releases of it. And it's pretty cool. And like there's Twitters and memes that are being sold, like the original tweet and the original meme. But as an artist, I think that there's going to be a lot of uses for it. And not only like for instance, I made a doodle of it's a quarter that has a bite out of it. Like someone took a bite out of it, and I called it a Bitcoin. And so it's a real simple doodle, and I minted it on a website called OpenSea. You can mint for free, and now since I minted it, it lives in my Coinbase wallet. There's a section for NFTs, so I have my little doodle with me always now. And then if I want to sell it, then it costs some Ethereum to sell. But again, like if you're an artist, you can. It's pretty cool that you can turn your art into a digital, digital asset.
Right.
And what's even cooler is that within the asset, once someone buys it, you can embed like a special download perk. So not only do they get the NFT, that you can have a sound clip, you can have a video clip, you can have like a ticket for a concert or an event that you're putting on. It's really neat. So it's kind of like the way I see it is for artists, it's their time now to own their creative work. And to own their work and have 100% control over it. And I think this is going to be pretty neat for the future of creative work.
And then the other part about it too is if somebody sells that to somebody else, there's still a way that you get paid off of that, like as a future. So like the artist never loses out, right? Like, so basically like if I bought your artwork and then I sell it to somebody else, whatever they pay for it, you get a portion of that back as well, correct?
Yeah. If you set up your NFT with royalties, you can do that. Not all websites give that option though, so you gotta be careful.
Does OpenSea do that? Does it give you the
OpenSea? I think it gives you like a default of 10%. You gotta double check, but yeah. So if you make sure that you have that royalty, then every time it's sold after you sell it, you'll get 10% of the royalty back to you.
That's so amazing. And I think that's right. I think that artists, because we've seen this before. Like they do it in movies, so I don't know about real life, but like an artist will sell artwork for like $50,000, and then they'll be like, "Oh, I sold that. That art's worth $10 million now." Well, the artist is never going to see any of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because the person selling it is gonna keep it or whatever. And while I can see both sides of that, like, oh, you paid for it, so you should get to sell the difference, I also think artists should be paid for their work, and that if you're going to make a profit off of their work, they should also make a percentage of the profit off of that work. Like for me, that's what I would do. I wish I could do that with my comic books. Like I haven't sold any comic books, but if I was gonna sell anything, like I'd love to give that comic creator that I paid for a portion of that money back because they created it, right? Like yes, I bought the item, but if I'm selling it for more money, like, I have a Walking Dead issue number 100. It's the one where Glenn dies, if you guys know what Walking Dead is. And I paid like 125 or 150 bucks for that. And it's signed by Robert Kirkman. So it's a signed, sealed, graded comic book. If I turn around and sold that for 250 bucks, I feel like Robert Kirkman should get a portion of that money back because he created the comic book, right? You're like, sure, it was already paid for, sure, all that stuff was done, but it's like, okay, yeah, but I'm making a profit off of his work. I don't know how that works, and I wish NFTs could be assigned to physical items too, but I don't think there's a way to do that, right?
No, well, unless it's like the NFT like opens up a locker with a physical item in it or something, you know, like a QR code that'll open something else.
So that'd be cool. So if you guys want to know all about that, Luke, I think Luke is going to try to do something on Fiverr where he helps people do NFTs. And I think that would be a good thing. And maybe be based on a digital size, like how many gigs or whatever it costs or a percentage of something. I don't know. There's got to be a way to do it. But I think NFTs are going to be a big thing. And the comedians, I think the big thing for them is going to be maybe making a joke that only exists on this one NFT. Like, yes, you've told this joke, but now maybe you're going to retire that joke. So you take that joke, you put it in an NFT form, maybe it has like a meme or you as the cover or something like that, you doing that particular joke, then you retire that joke, you sell that NFT. That NFT contains that audio or video file of that joke, and then it's gone forever. That person owns that joke. You no longer do it anymore. It doesn't exist in the world except for in that NFT. And you sell it for, you know, $100 or $1,000 or if you're Jim Gaffigan or Jerry Seinfeld, maybe $1 million. And I think that would be good. I think that's what Jerry Seinfeld should do, is go take his old jokes, see if he has a video of that or the audio of it. Take that joke, turn it into like a him in that time period picture or whatever. Have that whole thing put together, sell it for a thing. Because I'd buy like if Jerry Seinfeld was selling one of his jokes, it's my joke forever after that. For $1,000, I'd buy it in a heartbeat because why not?
Well, there is the option to retain copyright though. So
what does that mean?
So if he wants to retain the copyright on the joke, he still owns the joke, but you just own the digital version of the joke.
Oh, like so he can still tell the joke.
Yeah, if they retain the copyright.
But I think the coolest part would be like you retire that joke. No one else in the world will ever hear that joke again. That I think would make it more valuable. I think if you're still doing that joke, it'd be like, why? I can go see you do it on stage or watch it on YouTube or you know what I'm saying? So it's like, if you retire that joke, it'd be great.
And that would be great. Like all the, you know, the Chris Rocks and all of them auction off like their, and then you own that joke. Then you're owning history basically at that point.
If Chris Rock ever sells his daddy joke, and if you guys aren't familiar with it, be like, mama, 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 everybody loves mama, but nobody gives about daddy. Like if he sells that joke, like I will literally buy that joke. That is one of my favorite Chris Rock jokes of all time. What does daddy get? The big pork chop. The reason I love that joke is because not only is that joke hilarious, but he also took that joke and turned it into an episode of Everybody Hates Chris. There's that exact episode where Terry Crews is the dad and they fight and it's all about the pork chop that's for their dad. It's such a, like those two things tying together. If he like somehow took that video clip from Everybody Hates Chris, put the daddy joke over that and like that was the NFT. Dude, $1,000 I'd pay that for no problem. I don't have $1,000 right now. So Chris, just wait. But when you're ready to do that, let me know. We'll do it. I think it'd be awesome. Well, thank you, Luke. Where can people find you at?
Luke LaCoy, mostly Instagram. I'm the most active.
You're most active. And don't forget to go to our subreddit, our Clean Comedy Podcast. It's growing. There are people going on there. We're seeing a lot more action. There's Q&As every month. So we're going to do monthly Q&As, which means you guys will get to ask questions. Luke and I will give answers. We might even bring other comedians on to come give answers so we can pull some of our friends, some of the people that we had on before. So if you have particular questions or something that maybe we don't know, you know, we can pull Robert G. Lee, David Studebaker, Darren Carter. We have so many people that are our friends that are willing to come and talk to us. So that's what we're working on. And we have some great, great people coming up soon. I don't want to call people out yet, but we have a movie comedy writers that created a movie for less than, I think it cost them $10,000. So that's insane. Like we're going to get to see behind it and they all wrote it. They all work together. So they're all going to come on. Then we have a fictionalized scripted podcast that is doing well. It's getting some heat and stuff. And I've worked with this guy. We actually did it here. He was one of the sponsors of Here on City Radio. So that's coming. And we're going to talk to him about what it takes to create a scripted podcast. Cause this isn't scripted. What we do isn't scripted. We have some notes or we write down stuff, questions we ask, but it's not scripted. And we kind of go off the cuff, but this is a written down, scripted, acted out, like with sound effects and songs and like just all kinds of crazy stuff. And voices and voice actors and what. So we're gonna talk to him about that. And then we got some other people that I'm reaching out to. I'm hoping that we're gonna get them some bigger name comedians that I'm really hoping come. So if you know people, or there's certain people that you want on, please let us know. I'm trying to get in touch with some people, so we would love to have it. And what I would like to do, I'm seeing that there's a large amount of downloads in India, okay, which that excites me. What I would like to do is if any of you that are listening in India know a comedian in India who speaks pretty good English, because I would hate to misunderstand somebody or not understand them. So if they speak English and Hindi, that's okay. Who is doing well in India, who you like, who's blowing up. Don't say Russell Peters. Like I know Russell Peters is Indian Canadian, but like, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like somebody who lives in India, who is doing comedy, who is like a comedian that, you know, give them our email and have them email me. I will set up a different time because I know time zones are kind of weird with that. And we would love to have them on because I would love to talk about what's happening in India, because it sounds like comedy is really blowing up and growing there. And I don't know any comedians from that part of the world. So if you're listening to this in India, you know of somebody, pass our information on. We're more than happy to talk to them. We would love to have them. If they have a book or an album or whatever, you can send it our way. We'd be glad to listen to it. We seriously, I want comedy to spread across the world. I feel like comedy is like love, right? We could share it around the world. People will be happier. When you laugh, you can't be angry. You can't be upset. Can't be mad at people. You just laugh, man. It's just great. So thank you so much for listening. Please like, subscribe, and have a wonderful day. Bye.